Good morning. On today's programme, we look ahead to crunch elections in Turkey and how several African countries are attempting to tackle the spread of Ebola. But first to France, where there's a growing political storm over the murder of a 12-year-old girl whose body was found in a plastic suitcase in Paris. A 24-year-old woman, an Algerian immigrant, has been arrested on suspicion of killing Lola Davier. Right-wing politicians have seized on the fact that the woman is an immigrant who'd already been ordered to leave France. From Paris, Rory Mulholland reports.
12-year-old Lola Davier was brutally murdered in her own apartment building after walking home from school on Friday, 14th of October. The school is called Collège Brassens, named after the late French singer and poet Georges Brassens. It's a school I know well, as my now 18-year-old son went there for 4 years. I accompanied him there for his first weeks at the school when he was 11, because a big city like Paris has its fair share of dodgy characters hanging around the streets. And as a parent, you're naturally nervous about your child venturing out alone. But soon I let him travel the few short stops on the metro on his own, as he was, after all, at secondary school now, and it really wasn't cool for your dad to be seen delivering you to the school gate. Lola Davio's parents likely made the same choice as me about letting their 12-year-old walk home. And Lola had only about 2 minutes to walk from the school to her apartment building, where her father was the concierge. But she was tragically unlucky to have encountered her killer on that short distance. The details of her death that have emerged are gruesome. The alleged killer, a 24-year-old Algerian, has been charged with rape, murder and acts of torture. The murder naturally made the headlines and attracted much political attention. On the following Monday, the French education minister and the mayor of Paris turned up at Collège Brassens in a show of solidarity as the shocked pupils returned to school. President Emmanuel Macron later in the week received Lola's family at the Élysée Palace to offer his condolences. But Lola's murder also received political attention that her family very firmly rejected. The right-wing Les Républicains, the party of the late Jacques Chirac and ex-president Nicolas Sarkozy, and the far-right Rassemblement National of Marine Le Pen focused on the fact that the suspected killer was an Algerian illegal immigrant. The suspect had recently received an official order to leave France, but had not done so. Both these political parties had campaigned against what they call out-of-control immigration in the general elections held in France earlier this year. A French Senate report found that while 143,226 deportation orders were issued last year, only 1 in 10 were actually carried out. Marine Le Pen told Parliament that, quote, too many crimes are being committed by illegal immigrants that the country has not been able or willing to deport, end of quote. Allies of President Macron denounced what they called a callous attempt to exploit a tragedy and score political points. But perhaps the most callous response of them all was that of the extreme right failed presidential candidate Eric Zemmour. He called the murder a francocide. He said it fitted into his conspiracy theory that immigrants are involved in a so-called great replacement scheme to get rid of native French and take over the country. Zemmour ignored Lola's family's appeal to stop politicising her death. His party held a street rally on Thursday in Paris, during which the protesters held up posters bearing Lola's photo. The girl's family have not commented publicly on this rally, but had repeatedly called upon Zemmour and all other politicians to stop using their daughter's death for their own ends. The family has retreated to the small northern French town from which the parents originally came. They are due to bury their daughter in the region on Monday. For World Report, this is Rory Mulholland in Paris.
To Turkey next, where the country is looking ahead to elections scheduled for June of next year. For the first time in many years, the combined opposition is favoured to win, but their prospects for success might be going to their heads, as Jasper Mortimer reports.
An opposition party has put up posters all over Ankara, showing a picture of its leader waving cheerfully to the people. The poster says, az kaldı, which means not much left. The party is saying there are only 8 months to go before the voters boot President Recep Tayyip Erdogan out of office in the June elections. The demise of Erdogan's 20-year rule of Turkey would be welcomed by many people. Inflation is officially 83%. Independent experts say it's 186%. Unemployment is 9.6%. 2 years ago, one could buy a dollar with 8 Turkish lira. Today, one needs 18.5 lira. An economic deterioration much less severe than this caused the British Prime Minister to sack the Chancellor of the Exchequer, cancel a pillar of her policies, and left her fighting for her survival. In Turkey, there has been no such crisis. Voters can only pine for the 5 yearly elections. The opposition is confident that this time things are going its way. One of the most respected polling companies in Turkey, Metropol, has found that if elections were to be held today, Erdogan's Justice and Development Party, known in Turkish as the AK Party, would get 33.6% of the vote once undecided votes had been distributed. That is 9% less than what it got in the 2018 elections. But Metropol also found that in the past 6 months, the AK Party vote has increased by about 4%. This is surprising because Turks vote according to their pockets, and economically, the trend has been downhill. The director of Metropol, Özer Sencar, says what's been happening is that AK Party voters who were disillusioned with Erdogan, who became undecided voters, have been returning to the AK Party. In an interview with Irish Radio, Sencar said they had returned not because they missed the AK Party's emphasis on Islam, but because they didn't believe the opposition parties could solve the problems. Sencar suspects the opposition parties don't realize that they're failing to win over the undecided voters. Complacency is distorting their judgment. Another analyst, the political scientist İhsan Dağ of the Middle East Technical University, issued a similar warning in January. He said there are many ways to lose an election, and one of them is to believe you're definitely going to win it. Dağ gave two examples of recent elections in professional bodies, the Ankara Chamber of Engineers and the National Bar Association. In both bodies, the preponderance of sympathies favoured the opposition. But when the votes were counted, the winners turned out to be pro-government candidates. The opposition had squandered its votes among many rival candidates. Dağ said the opposition parties, and there are 7, have got to get their act together. They have to coordinate. Another way to lose the election is for the opposition to assume they're going to win because of the state of the economy. Sencar said this assumption is incorrect. He predicted that in the months leading up to June, President Erdogan will embark on election economics, raising the minimum wage, raising grants for students, doling out sweeteners to turn the votes of people with short memories. Sencar said the key issue in these elections is who the opposition will nominate for the presidency. To beat Erdogan, the opposition must unite behind a winner. Sencar predicted that if the opposition chooses the wrong candidate, it will lose the presidency and the parliament. This is the opposition's biggest challenge. There are 3 names in the running: Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, the leader of the biggest opposition party; Mansur Yavaş, the mayor of Ankara; Ekrem İmamoğlu, the mayor of Istanbul. All belong to the same party. Each has his strengths and weaknesses. And whoever is chosen must appeal to the elephant in the room, the Kurdish voters. It will not be an easy decision. For World Report, this is Jasper Mortimer in Ankara.
Finally, we go to Africa, where several countries have joined the World Health Organization's attempt to halt the spread of Ebola. The virus has claimed the lives of 19 people so far and spread to 5 districts. As part of the WHO's program, $5 million US dollars will be ring-fenced for solutions to tackle the disease, such as increased surveillance and contact tracing. Amy Nirida reports from Kenya, one of the countries which has committed to the program.
Since Ugandan officials detected a pathogen known to cause the Ebola virus on September the 20th, the country has reported 64 cases and 25 deaths. Screening at the Kenyan-Ugandan border has been carried out since late September to help curb the spread of the disease. Similar to COVID-19 screening, tents were erected for those crossing the border at Busia and Malaba for work, in which they were required to carry out temperature checks twice daily. According to Dr. Melissa Latomia, the Acting Chief Officer for Health and Sanitation at the County Government of Busia, Ebola first presents higher fever in addition to the other signs and symptoms like headache, muscle pains, diarrhea and vomiting. If a high temperature is recorded, the person travelling is put into a holding room at the border in order for two more temperature checks to be carried out. On the instance in which it remains high, they are then taken to Alupe Hospital, where an isolation centre has been set up. Thousands of people have been screened at the border points. However, no cases of Ebola have been confirmed there. Yet hundreds of Ugandans, fearing they would be forced to quarantine, have been entering the country at other locations so that they could continue to go to work. Victor Kimani, who travels between the two countries daily at Sofia, says he's never been screened, nor has he seen any medical personnel on duty at the porous route being used by hundreds of residents. There have been many calls by those living on the border for the Ministry of Health to take action and stop residents from counties on either side from crossing freely. Locals want what they call pannier routes or illegal routes closed off. The calls have left health officials scratching their heads. The Ugandan president, Yoweri Museveni, had insisted the country would not fall victim to COVID-like restrictions again. He's since made a U-turn on that statement, now implementing a curfew in two Ugandan districts and halting all movement in and out of Mubende and Kassanda, just west of the country's capital, Kampala. It's a concerning move for newly elected Kenyan President William Ruto. It's unlikely he would favour heavy restrictions as the country's economy struggles to recover from the effects of COVID-19, the rise in energy prices and the increase in the cost of living. Meanwhile, the director of the Africa Centres for Disease Control, Dr. Ahmed Ogwell, has been advocating for a self-reliant strategy, insisting that Africa is on its own when it comes to infectious disease control and pandemics. Speaking at the UN General Assembly last month, he emphasised that his continent learned many lessons during the pandemic and stressed the importance of finding local solutions to strengthen health systems instead of relying on the West. The CDC is currently dealing with 11 different public health outbreaks: monkeypox, cholera, flooding, influenza, Lassa fever, measles, yellow fever, hepatitis E, and the Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever. While there are two licensed vaccines to protect against the Zara virus, there is no approved vaccine to deal with Uganda's Sudan Ebola virus outbreak. They are genetically distinct, and therefore cross-protection cannot be achieved. The WHO has confirmed that two vaccines are being prepared for trials to deal with the Sudan strain. African health ministers have agreed that joint measures are needed to curb the cross-border spread of the Ebola virus, and there is talk of creating a task force to deal with outbreaks on the continent. Kenya, Burundi and the Democratic Republic of Congo have agreed to increase contact tracing and jointly train emergency responders. The World Health Organization has pledged $5 million to the programme, of which around $2 million will be spent in Uganda. In a virtual presentation, the WHO Director General said the outbreak was troubling but not altogether unexpected, given Uganda's proximity to the Democratic Republic of Congo, which has recurring outbreaks. While Kenya has responded swiftly to the Ebola scare, the nation is still considered a high-risk country for the spread of the deadly virus. The National Task Force will continue to meet regularly to monitor the situation, but for those along the border, COVID-19 is long behind them, seemingly just a trial run for another disease with a staggering fatality rate, no vaccine and no cure. For World Report, this is Amy Nirieda in Nairobi, Kenya.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. But until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.